about a hurricane in its perfect power, or the climbing, falling colors of a rainbow. We had been received by her mother and had waited on the edge of our seats in the overfurnished living room. Dad talked easily with our grandmother, as white folks talk to blacks, unembarrassed and unapologetic. We were both fearful of mother's coming and impatient at her delay. It is remarkable how much truth there is in the two expressions, struck dumb and love at first sight. My mother's beauty literally assailed me. Her red lips, Mama said it was a sin to wear lipstick, split to show even white teeth, and her fresh butter color looked see-through clean. Her smile widened her mouth beyond her cheeks, beyond her ears, and seemingly through the walls to the street outside. I was struck dumb. I knew immediately why she had sent me away. She was too beautiful to have children. I had never seen a woman as pretty as she, who was called mother. Bailey, on his part, fell instantly and forever in love. I saw his eyes shining like hers. He had forgotten the loneliness and the nights when we had cried together because we were unwanted children. He had never left her warm side or shared the icy wind of solitude with me. She was his mother, dear, and I resigned myself to his condition. They were more alike than she and I, or even he and I. They both had physical beauty and personality, so I figured it figured. Our father left St. Louis a few days later for California, and I was neither glad nor sorry. He was a stranger, and if he chose to leave us with a stranger, it was all of one piece. 10. Grandmother Baxter was a quadroon, or an octoroon, or in any case, she was nearly white. She had been raised by a German family in Cairo, Illinois, and had come to St. Louis at the turn of the century to study nursing. While she was working at Homer G. Phillips Hospital, she met and married Grandfather Baxter. She was white, having no features that could even loosely be called Negroid, and he was black. While she spoke with a throaty German accent until her death, he had the choppy spouting speech of the West Indians. Their marriage was a happy one. Grandfather had a famous saying that caused great pride in his family. By Jesus, I live for my wife, my children, and my dog. He took extreme care to prove that statement true by taking the word of his family, even in the face of contradictory evidence. The Negro section of St. Louis in the mid-30s had all the finesse of a gold rush town. Prohibition, gambling, and their related vocations were so obviously practiced that it was hard for me to believe that they were against the law. Bailey and I, as newcomers, were quickly told by our schoolmates who the men on the street corners were as we passed. I was sure that they had taken their names from Wild West books. Hard-hitting Jimmy, Two-Gun, Sweet Man, Poker Pete, and to prove me right, they hung around in front of saloons like unhorsed cowboys. We met the numbers runners, gamblers, lottery takers, and whiskey salesmen, not only in the loud streets, but in our orderly living room as well. They were often there when we returned from school, sitting with hats in their hands, as we had done upon our arrival in the big city. They silently waited for Grandmother Baxter. Her white skin and the pince-nez that she dramatically took from her nose and let hang free on a chain, pinned to her dress, were factors that brought her a great deal of respect. Moreover, the reputation of her six mean children and the fact that she was a precinct captain compounded her power and gave her the leverage to deal with even the lowest crook without fear. She had pull with the police department, so the men in their flashy suits and fleshy scars sat with church-like decorum and waited to ask favors from her. If grandmother raised the heat off their gambling parlors or said the word, that reduced the bail of a friend waiting in jail. They knew what would be expected of them. Come election, they were to bring in the votes from their neighborhood. She most often got them leniency, and they always brought in the vote. St. Louis also introduced me to thin-sliced ham. I thought it a delicacy. Jelly beans and peanuts mixed, lettuce on sandwich bread, Victrolas, and family loyalty. In Arkansas, where we cured our own meat, we ate half-inch slabs of ham for breakfast. But in St. Louis, we bought the paper-thin slices in a strange-smelling German store and ate them in sandwiches. If grandmother never lost her German accent, she also never lost her taste for the thick black German Brot, which we bought unsliced. In stamps, lettuce was used only to make a bed for potato salad or slaw, and peanuts were brought in raw from the field and roasted in the bottom of the oven on cold nights. The rich scents used to fill the house, and we were always expected to eat too many, but that was a stamps custom. In St. Louis, peanuts were bought in paper bags and mixed with jelly beans, which meant that we ate the salt and sugar together, and I found them a delicious treat, the best thing the big town had to offer. When we enrolled in Toussaint de Louverture Grammar School, we were struck by the ignorance of our schoolmates and the rudeness of our teachers. Only the vastness of the building impressed us. Not even the white school in Stamps was as large. The students, however, were shockingly backward. Bailey and I did arithmetic at a mature level because of our work in the store. And we read well because in Stamps there wasn't anything else to do. We were moved up a grade because our teachers thought that we country children would make our classmates feel inferior, and we did. Bailey would not refrain from remarking on our classmates' lack of knowledge. At lunchtime in the large gray concrete playground, he would stand in the center of a crowd of big boys and ask, "Who was Napoleon Bonaparte? How many feet make a mile?" It was infighting, Bailey style. Any of the boys might have been able to beat him with their fists, but if they did, they'd just have had to do it again the next day, and Bailey never held a brief for fighting fair. He taught me that once I got into a fight, I should grab for the balls right away. He never answered when I asked, "Suppose I'm fighting a girl?" We went to school there a full year, but all I remember hearing that I hadn't heard before was, "Making thousands of egg-shaped oughts will improve penmanship." The teachers were more formal than those we knew in Stamps, and although they didn't whip their students with switches, they gave them licks in the palms of their hands with rulers. In Stamps, teachers were much friendlier, but that was because they were imported from the Arkansas Negro colleges. And since we had no hotels or rooming houses in town, they had to live with private families. If a lady teacher took company or didn't receive any mail or cried alone in her room at night, by the week's end, even the children discussed her morality, her loneliness, and her other failings generally. It would have been near impossible to maintain formality under a small town's invasions of privacy. St. Louis teachers, on the other hand, tended to act very sedate and talk down to their students from the lofty heights of education and white folks' enunciation. They, women as well as men, all sounded like my father with their errs and errers. They walked with their knees together and talked through tight lips, as if they were as afraid to let the sound out as they were to inhale the dirty air that the listener gave off. We walked to school around walls of bricks and breathed the coal dust for one discouraging winter. We learned to say yes and no rather than yes, ma'am, and no, ma'am. Occasionally, Mother, whom we seldom saw in the house, had us meet her at Louis's. It was a long, dark tavern at the end of the bridge near our school, and was owned by two Syrian brothers. We used to come in the back door, and the sawdust, stale beer, steam, and boiling meat made me feel as if I'd been eating mothballs. Mother had cut my hair in a bob like hers and straightened it, so my head felt skinned and the back of my neck so bare that I was ashamed to have anyone walk up behind me. Naturally, this kept me turning quickly, as if I expected something to happen. At Louis's, we were greeted by Mother's friends as Bibby's darling babies, and were given soft drinks and boiled shrimp. While we sat on the stiff wooden booths, Mother would dance alone in front of us to music from the Seaburg. I loved her most at that time. She was like a pretty kite that floated just above my head. If I liked, I could pull it to me by saying, "I have to go to the toilet," or by starting a fight with Bailey. I never did either, but the power made me tender to her. The Syrian brothers vied for her attention as she sang the heavy blues that Bailey and I almost understood. They watched her, even when directing their conversation to other customers. I know they, too, were hypnotized by this beautiful lady, who talked with her whole body and snapped her fingers louder than anyone in the whole world. We learned the time step at Louis's. It is from this basic step that most American black dancers are born. It is a series of taps, jumps, and rests, and demands careful listening, feeling, and coordination. We were brought before Mother's friends there in the heavy saloon air to show our artistry. Bailey learned easily and has always been the better dancer, but I learned too. I approached the time step with the same determination to win that I had approached the times tables with. There was no Uncle Willie or sizzling pot-bellied stove, but there was Mother and her laughing friends, and they amounted to the same thing. We were applauded and given more soft drinks and more shrimp, but it was to be years before I found the joy and freedom of dancing well. Mother's brothers, Uncle Tootie, Tom, and Ira, were well-known young men about St. Louis. They all had city jobs, which I now understand to have been no mean feat for Negro men. Their jobs and their families set them apart, but they were best known for their unrelenting meanness. Grandfather had told them, "By Jesus, if you ever get in jail for stealing or some such foolishness, I'll let you rot. But if you're arrested for fighting, I'll sell the house, lock, stock, and barrel to get you out." With that kind of encouragement, backed by explosive tempers, it was no wonder they became fearsome characters. Our youngest uncle, Billy, was not old enough to join in their didos, but one of their most flamboyant escapades has become a proud family legend. Pat Patterson, a big man, who was himself protected by the shield of a bad reputation, made the mistake of cursing my mother one night when she was out alone. She reported the incident to her brothers. They ordered one of their hangers-on to search the streets for Patterson, and when he was located, to telephone them. As they waited throughout the afternoon, the living room filled with smoke and the murmurs of plans. From time to time, Grandfather came in from the kitchen and said, "Don't kill him. Mind you, just don't kill him." Then went back to his coffee with Grandmother. They went to the saloon where Patterson sat drinking at a small table. Uncle Tommy stood by the door. Uncle Tootie stationed himself at the toilet door, and Uncle Ira, who was the oldest and maybe everyone's ideal, walked over to Patterson. They were all obviously carrying guns. Uncle Ira said to my mother, "Here, Bibby, here's this nigger Patterson. Come over here and beat his ass." She crashed the man's head with a policeman's billy, enough to leave him just this side of death. There was no police investigation, nor social reprobation. After all, didn't Grandfather champion their wild tempers? And wasn't Grandmother a near white woman with police pull? I admit that I was thrilled by their meanness. They beat up whites and blacks with the same abandon, and liked each other so much that they never needed to learn the art of making outside friends. My mother was the only warm, outgoing personality among her siblings. Grandfather became bedridden during our stay there, and his children spent their free time telling him jokes, gossiping with him, and showing their love. Uncle Tommy, who was gruff and chewed his words like Grandfather, was my favorite. He strung ordinary sentences together, and they came out sounding either like the most profane curses or like comical poetry. A natural comedian, he never waited for the laugh that he knew must follow his droll statements. He was never cruel. He was mean. When we played handball on the side of our house, Uncle Tommy would turn the corner coming from work. He would pretend at first not to see us, but with the deftness of a cat, he would catch the ball and say, "Put your minds where your behinds are, and I'll let you own my team." We children would range around him, but it was only when he reached the steps that he'd wind up his arm and throw the ball over the light post and toward the stars. He told me often, "Reetie, don't worry 'cause you ain't pretty. Pretty women I seen digging ditches, or worse, you smart. I swear to God, I'd rather you have a good mind than a cute behind." They bragged often about the binding quality of the Baxter blood. Uncle Tommy said that even the children felt it before they were old enough to be taught. They reminisced over Bailey teaching me to walk when he was less than 3. Displeased at my stumbling motions, he was supposed to have said, "This is my sister. I have to teach her to walk." They also told me how I got the name Mai. After Bailey learned definitely that I was his sister, he refused to call me Marguerite, but rather addressed me each time as Maya's sister. And in later, more articulate years, after the need for brevity had shortened the appellation to Mai, it was elaborated into Maya. We lived in a big house on Caroline Street with our grandparents for half the year before Mother moved us in with her. Moving from the house where the family was centered meant absolutely nothing to me. It was simply a small pattern in the grand design of our lives. If other children didn't move so much, it just went to show that our lives were fated to be different from everyone else's in the world. The new house was no stranger than the other, except that we were with Mother. Bailey persisted in calling her Mother Dear, until the circumstance of proximity softened the phrase's formality to Mud Dear, and finally to Medea. I could never put my finger on her realness. She was so pretty and so quick that even when she had just awakened, her eyes full of sleep and hair tousled, I thought she looked just like the Virgin Mary. But what mother and daughter understand each other, or even have the sympathy for each other's lack of understanding? Mother had prepared a place for us, and we went to it gratefully. We each had a room with a 2-sheeted bed, plenty to eat, and store-bought clothes to wear. And after all, she didn't have to do it. If we got on her nerves, or if we were disobedient, she could always send us back to stamps. The weight of appreciation and the threat, which was never spoken, of a return to Mama were burdens that clogged my childish wits into impassivity. I was called old lady and chided for moving and talking like winter's molasses. Mother's boyfriend, Mr. Freeman, lived with us, or we lived with him. I never quite knew which. He was a southerner, too, and big, but a little flabby. His breasts used to embarrass me when he walked around in his undershirt. They lay on his chest like flat titties. Even if Mother hadn't been such a pretty woman, light-skinned with straight hair, he was lucky to get her, and he knew it. She was educated, from a well-known family, and after all, wasn't she born in St. Louis? Then she was gay. She laughed all the time and made jokes. He was grateful. I think he must have been many years older than she. But if not, he had the sluggish inferiority of old men married to younger women. He watched her every move, and when she left the room, his eyes allowed her, reluctantly, to go. 11. I had decided that St. Louis was a foreign country. I would never get used to the scurrying sounds of flushing toilets, or the packaged foods, or doorbells, or the noise of cars and trains and buses that crashed through the walls or slipped under the doors. In my mind, I only stayed in St. Louis for a few weeks. As quickly as I understood that I had not reached my home, I sneaked away to Robin Hood's forest and the caves of Aleut, where all reality was unreal, and even that changed every day. I carried the same shield I had used in stamps. I didn't come to stay. Mother was competent in providing for us, even if that meant getting someone else to furnish the provisions. Although she was a nurse, she never worked at her profession while we were with her. Mr. Freeman brought in the necessities, and she earned extra money cutting poker games in gambling parlors. The straight 8-to-5 world simply didn't have enough glamour for her. And it was 20 years later that I first saw her in a nurse's uniform. Mr. Freeman was a foreman in the Southern Pacific Yards and came home late sometimes after Mother had gone out. He took his dinner off the stove where she had carefully covered it and which she had admonished us not to bother. He ate quietly in the kitchen while Bailey and I read separately and greedily over our own Street and Smith pulp magazine. Now that we had spending money, we bought the illustrated paperbacks with their gaudy pictures. When Mother was away, we were put on an honor system. We were asked to finish our homework, eat dinner, and wash the dishes before we could read or listen to the Lone Ranger, Crime Busters, or the Shadow. Mr. Freeman moved gracefully like a big brown bear and seldom spoke to us. He simply waited for Mother and put his whole self into the waiting. He never read the paper or patted his foot to radio. He waited, that was all. If she came home before we went to bed, we saw the man come alive. He would start out of the big chair like a man coming out of sleep, smiling. I would remember then that a few seconds before I had heard a car door slam. Then Mother's footsteps would signal from the concrete walk. When her key rattled the door, Mr. Freeman would have already asked his habitual question, "Hey, Bibby, have a good time?" His query would hang in the air while she sprang over to peck him on the lips. Then she turned to Bailey and me with lipstick kisses. "Haven't you finished your homework?" If we had and were just reading, "Okay, say your prayers and go to bed." If we hadn't, "Then go to your room and finish, then say your prayers and go to bed." Mr. Freeman's smile never grew. It stayed at the same intensity. Sometimes Mother would go over and sit on his lap, and the grin on his face looked as if it would stay there forever. From our rooms, we could hear the glasses clink and the radio turned up. I think she must have danced for him on the good nights, because he couldn't dance. But before I fell asleep, I often heard feet shuffling to dance rhythms. I felt very sorry for Mr. Freeman. I felt as sorry for him as I had felt for a litter of helpless pigs born in our backyard sty in Arkansas. We fattened the pigs all year long for slaughter on the first good frost, and even as I suffered for the cute little wiggly things, I knew how much I was going to enjoy the fresh sausage and hogshead cheese they could give me only with their deaths. Because of the lurid tales we read and our vivid imaginations and probably memories of our brief but hectic lives, Bailey and I were afflicted, he physically and I mentally. He stuttered and I sweated through horrifying nightmares. He was constantly told to slow down and start again. And on my particularly bad nights, my mother would take me in to sleep with her in the large bed with Mr. Freeman. Because of a need for stability, children easily become creatures of habit. After the third time in mother's bed, I thought there was nothing strange about sleeping there. One morning she got out of bed for an early errand, and I fell asleep again. But I awoke to a pressure, a strange feeling on my left leg. It was too soft to be a hand, and it wasn't the touch of clothes. Whatever it was, I hadn't encountered the sensation in all the years of sleeping with Mama. It didn't move, and I was too startled to. I turned my head a little to the left to see if Mr. Freeman was awake and gone. But his eyes were open and both hands were above the cover. I knew, as if I had always known, it was his thing on my leg. He said, "Just stay there, Riti. I ain't gonna hurt you." I wasn't afraid, a little apprehensive maybe, but not afraid. Of course, I knew that lots of people did it, and they used their things to accomplish the deed. But no one I knew had ever done it to anybody. Mr. Freeman pulled me to him and put his hand between my legs. He didn't hurt, but Mama had drilled into my head, "Keep your legs closed and don't let nobody see your pocketbook." "Now, I didn't hurt you. Don't get scared." He threw back the blankets and his thing stood up like a brown ear of corn. He took my hand and said, "Feel it." It was mushy and squirmy, like the inside of a freshly killed chicken. Then he dragged me on top of his chest with his left arm, and his right hand was moving so fast, and his heart was beating so hard, that I was afraid that he would die. Ghost stories revealed how people who died wouldn't let go of whatever they were holding. I wondered if Mr. Freeman died holding me, how would I ever get free? Would they have to break his arms to get me loose? Finally, he was quiet, and then came the nice part. He held me so softly that I wished he wouldn't ever let me go. I felt at home. From the way he was holding me, I knew he'd never let me go or let anything bad ever happen to me. This was probably my real father, and we had found each other at last. But then he rolled over, leaving me in a wet place, and stood up. "I got to talk to you, Riti." He pulled off his shorts that had fallen to his ankles and went into the bathroom. It was true the bed was wet, but I knew I hadn't had an accident. Maybe Mr. Freeman had one while he was holding me. He came back with a glass of water and told me in a sour voice, "Get up. You peed in the bed." He poured water on the wet spot, and it did look like my mattress on many mornings. Having lived in Southern strictness, I knew when to keep quiet around adults, but I did want to ask him why he said I peed when I was sure he didn't believe that. If he thought I was naughty, would that mean that he would never hold me again or admit that he was my father? I had made him ashamed of me. "Riti, you love Bailey?" He sat down on the bed, and I came close, hoping. "Yes." He was bending down, pulling on his socks, and his back was so large and friendly, I wanted to rest my head on it. "If you ever tell anybody what we did, I'll have to kill Bailey." What had we done? We? Obviously, he didn't mean my peeing in the bed. I didn't understand and didn't dare ask him. It had something to do with his holding me. But there was no chance to ask Bailey either, because that would be telling what we had done. The thought that he might kill Bailey stunned me. After he left the room, I thought about telling Mother that I hadn't peed in the bed. But then, if she asked me what happened, I'd have to tell her about Mr. Freeman holding me, and that wouldn't do. It was the same old quandary. I had always lived it. there was an army of adults whose motives and movements I just couldn't understand, and who made no effort to understand mine. There was never any question of my disliking Mr. Friedman. I simply didn't understand him either. For weeks after, he said nothing to me except the gruff hellos, which were given without ever looking in my direction. This was the first secret I had ever kept from Bailey, and sometimes I thought he should be able to read it on my face, but he noticed nothing. I began to feel lonely for Mr. Freeman and the encasement of his big arms. Before, my world had been Bailey, food, Mama, the store, reading books, and Uncle Willie. Now, for the first time, it included physical contact. I began to wait for Mr. Freeman to come in from the yards. But when he did, he never noticed me, although I put a lot of feeling into "Good evening, Mr. Freeman." One evening, when I couldn't concentrate on anything, I went over to him and sat quickly on his lap. He'd been waiting for Mother again. Bailey was listening to The Shadow and didn't miss me. At first, Mr. Freeman sat still, not holding me or anything. Then I felt a soft lump under my thigh begin to move. It twitched against me and started to harden. Then he pulled me to his chest. He smelled of coal dust and grease, and he was so close, I buried my face in his shirt and listened to his heart. It was beating just for me. Only I could hear the thud. Only I could feel the jumping on my face. He said, "Sit still, stop squirming." But all the time he pushed me around on his lap. Then suddenly he stood up, and I slipped down to the floor. He ran to the bathroom. For months he stopped speaking to me again. I was hurt, and for a time felt lonelier than ever. But then I forgot about him, and even the memory of his holding me precious melted into the general darkness just beyond the great blinkers of childhood. I read more than ever, and wished my soul that I had been born a boy. Horatio Alger was the greatest writer in the world. His heroes were always good, always won, and were always boys. I could have developed the first two virtues, but becoming a boy was sure to be difficult, if not impossible. The Sunday funnies influenced me, and although I had admired the strong heroes, who always conquered in the end, I identified with Tiny Tim. In the toilet where I used to take the papers, it was torturous to look for and exclude the unnecessary pages so that I could learn how he would finally outwit his latest adversary. I wept with relief every Sunday as he eluded the evil men and bounded back from each seeming defeat as sweet and gentle as ever. The Cats and Jammer kids were fun because they made the adults look stupid, but they were a little too smart-alecky for my taste. When spring came to St. Louis, I took out my first library card, and since Bailey and I seemed to be growing apart, I spent most of my Saturdays at the library. No interruptions. Breathing in the world of penniless shoeshine boys who, with goodness and perseverance, became rich, rich men, and gave baskets of goodies to the poor on holidays. The little princesses who were mistaken for maids and the long-lost children mistaken for waifs became more real to me than our house, our mother, our school, or Mr. Freeman. During those months, we saw our grandparents and the uncles. Our only aunt had gone to California to build her fortune. But they usually asked the same question, "Have you been good children?" For which there was only one answer. Even Bailey wouldn't have dared to answer no. 12. On a late spring Saturday, after our chores, nothing like those in stamps, were done, Bailey and I were going out, he to play baseball and I to the library. Mr. Freeman said to me after Bailey had gone downstairs, "Reetie, go get some milk for the house." Mother usually brought milk when she came in, but that morning as Bailey and I straightened the living room, her bedroom door had been open and we knew that she hadn't come home the night before. He gave me the money, and I rushed to the store and back to the house. After putting the milk in the icebox, I turned and had just reached the front door when I heard, "Riti." He was sitting in the big chair by the radio. "Riti, come here." I didn't think about the holding time till I got close to him. His pants were open, and his thing was standing out of his breeches by itself. "No, sir, Mr. Freeman." I started to back away. I didn't want to touch that mushy, hard thing again, and I didn't need him to hold me anymore. He grabbed my arm and pulled me between his legs. His face was still and looked kind, but he didn't smile or blink his eyes. Nothing. He did nothing except reach his left hand around to turn on the radio without even looking at it. Over the noise of music and static, he said, "Now, this ain't gonna hurt you much. You liked it before, didn't you?" I didn't want to admit that I had, in fact, liked his holding me, or that I had liked his smell of the hard heart beating. So I said nothing, and his face became like the face of one of those mean natives the phantom was always having to beat up. His legs were squeezing my waist. "Pull down your drawers." I hesitated for two reasons. He was holding me too tight to move, and I was sure that any minute my mother or Bailey or the Green Hornet would burst in the door and save me. "We was just playing before." He released me enough to snatch down my bloomers, and then he dragged me closer to him. Turning the radio up loud, too loud, he said, "If you scream, I'm going to kill you. And if you tell, I'm going to kill Bailey." I could tell he meant what he said. I couldn't understand why he wanted to kill my brother. Neither of us had done anything to him. And then there was the pain, a breaking and entering, when even the senses are torn apart. The act of rape on an 8-year-old body is a matter of the needle giving because the camel can't. The child gives because the body can and the mind of the violator cannot. I thought I had died. I woke up in a white-walled world, and it had to be heaven. But Mr. Freeman was there, and he was washing me. His hands shook, but he held me upright in the tub and washed my legs. "I didn't mean to hurt you, Rita. I didn't mean it. But don't you tell. Remember, don't you tell a soul." I felt cool and very clean and just a little tired. "No, sir, Miss Freeman. I won't tell." I was somewhere above everything. "It's just that I'm so tired. I'll just go and lay down a while, please." I whispered to him. I thought if I spoke out loud, he might become frightened and hurt me again. He dried me and handed me my bloomers. "Put these on and go to the library. Your mama ought to be coming home soon. You just act natural." Walking down the street, I felt the wet on my pants, and my hips seemed to be coming out of their sockets. I couldn't sit long on the hard seats in the library. They had been constructed for children. So I walked by the empty lot where Bailey was playing ball, but he wasn't there. I stood for a while and watched the big boys tear around the dusty diamond and then headed home. After 2 blocks, I knew I'd never make it, not unless I counted every step and stepped on every crack. I had started to burn between my legs more than the time I'd wasted Sloan's liniment on myself. My legs throbbed, or rather the insides of my thighs throbbed, with the same force that Mr. Freeman's heart had beaten. Thrum, step, step on the crack, thrum, step. I went up the stairs one at a time. No one was in the living room, so I went straight to bed, after hiding my red and yellow stained drawers under the mattress. When Mother came in, she said, "Well, young lady, I believe this is the first time I've seen you go to bed without being told. You must be sick." I wasn't sick, but the pit of my stomach was on fire. How could I tell her that? Bailey came in later and asked me what the matter was. There was nothing to tell him. When Mother called us to eat, and I said I wasn't hungry, she laid her cool hand on my forehead and cheeks. Maybe it's the measles. They say they're going around the neighborhood. After she took my temperature, she said, "You have a little fever. You've probably just caught them." Mr. Freeman took up the whole doorway. "Then Bailey ought not to be in there with her, unless you want a house full of sick children." She answered over her shoulder, "He may as well have them now as later. Get them over with." She brushed by Mr. Freeman as if he were made of cotton. "Come on, Junior, get some cool towels and wipe your sister's face." As Bailey left the room, Mr. Freeman advanced to the bed. He leaned over, his whole face a threat that could have smothered me. "If you tell," and again so softly I almost didn't hear it, "if you tell." I couldn't summon up the energy to answer him. He had to know I wasn't going to tell anything. Bailey came in with the towels and Mr. Freeman walked out. Later, Mother made a broth and sat on the edge of the bed to feed me. The liquid went down my throat like bones. My belly and behind were as heavy as cold iron, but it seemed my head had gone away and pure air had replaced it on my shoulders. Bailey read to me from the Rover Boys until he got sleepy and went to bed. That night I kept waking to hear Mother and Mr. Freeman arguing. I couldn't hear what they were saying, but I did hope she wouldn't make him so mad that he'd hurt her too. I knew he could do it with his cold face and empty eyes. Their voices came in faster and faster, the high sounds on the heels of the lows. I would have liked to have gone in and just passed through as if I were going to the toilet, just show my face and they might stop. But my legs refused to move. I could move the toes and ankles, but the knees had turned to wood. Maybe I slept, but soon morning was there, and Mother was pretty over my bed. "How are you feeling, baby?" "Fine, Mother," an instinctive answer. "Where's Bailey?" She said he was still asleep, but that she hadn't slept all night. She had been in my room off and on to see about me. I asked her where Mr. Freeman was, and her face chilled with remembered anger. "He's gone. Moved this morning. I'm going to take your temperature after I put on your cream of wheat." Could I tell her now? The terrible pain assured me that I couldn't. What he did to me and what I allowed must have been very bad if already God let me hurt so much. If Mr. Freeman was gone, did that mean Bailey was out of danger? And if so, if I told him, would he still love me? After Mother took my temperature, she said she was going to bed for a while, but to wake her if I felt sicker. She told Bailey to watch my face and arms for spots, and when they came up, he could paint them with calamine lotion. That Sunday goes and comes in my memory like a bad connection on an overseas telephone call. Once Bailey was reading the Cats and Jammer Kids to me. Then, without a pause for sleeping, Mother was looking closely at my face, and soup trickled down my chin. And some got into my mouth, and I choked. Then there was a doctor who took my temperature and held my wrist. "Bailey!" I suppose I had screamed, for he materialized suddenly, and I asked him to help me, and we'd run away to California, or France, or Chicago. I knew I was dying, and in fact I longed for death, but I didn't want to die anywhere near Mr. Freeman. I knew that even now he wouldn't have allowed death to have me, unless he wished it to. Mother said I should be bathed and the linens had to be changed, since I'd sweat so much. When they tried to move me, I fought, and even Bailey couldn't hold me. Then she picked me up in her arms, and the terror abated for a while. Bailey began to change the bed. As he pulled off the soiled sheets, he dislodged the panties I had put under the mattress. They fell at Mother's feet. 13. In the hospital, Bailey told me that I had to tell who did that to me, or the man would hurt another little girl. When I explained that I couldn't tell, because the man would kill him, Bailey said knowingly, "He can't kill me. I won't let him." And of course I believed him. Bailey didn't lie to me, so I told him. Bailey cried at the side of my bed until I started to cry too. Almost 15 years passed before I saw my brother cry again. Using the old brain he was born with, those were his words later on that day, he gave his information to Grandmother Baxter, and Mr. Freeman was arrested and was spared the awful wrath of my pistol-whipping uncles. I would have liked to stay in the hospital the rest of my life. Mother brought flowers and candy. Grandmother came with fruit, and my uncles clumped around and around my bed, snorting like wild horses. When they were able to sneak Bailey in, he read to me for hours. The saying that people who have nothing to do become busybodies is not the only truth. Excitement is a drug, and people whose lives are filled with violence are always wondering where the next fix is coming from. The court was filled. Some people even stood behind the church-like benches in the rear. Overhead fans moved with the detachment of old men. Grandmother Baxter's clients were there in gay and flippant array. The gamblers in pinstriped suits and their makeup deep women whispered to me out of blood-red mouths that now I knew as much as they did. I was 8 and grown. Even the nurses in the hospital had told me that now I had nothing to fear. "The worst is over for you," they had said. So I put the words in all the smirking mouths. I sat with my family. Bailey couldn't come, and they rested still on the seats like solid, cold, gray tombstones, thick and forever unmoving. Poor Mr. Freeman twisted in his chair to look empty threats over to me. He didn't know that he couldn't kill Bailey, and Bailey didn't lie to me. "What was the defendant wearing?" That was Mr. Freeman's lawyer. "I don't know." "You mean to say this man raped you and you don't know what he was wearing?" He snickered, as if I had raped Mr. Freeman. "Do you know if you were raped?" A sound pushed in the air of the court. I was sure it was laughter. I was glad that Mother had let me wear the navy blue winter coat with brass buttons. Although it was too short and the weather was typical St. Louis hot, the coat was a friend that I hugged to me in the strange and unfriendly place. "Was that the first time the accused touched you?" The question stopped me. Mr. Freeman had surely done something very wrong, but I was convinced that I had helped him to do it. I didn't want to lie, but the lawyer wouldn't let me think, so I used silence as a retreat. "Did the accused try to touch you before the time he, or rather, you say he raped you?" I couldn't say yes and tell them how he had loved me once for a few minutes and how he had held me close before he thought I had peed in my bed. My uncles would kill me, and Grandmother Baxter would stop speaking, as she often did when she was angry, and all those people in the court would stone me as they had stoned the harlot in the Bible. And Mother, who thought I was such a good girl, would be so disappointed. But most important, there was Bailey. I had kept a big secret from him. "Marguerite, answer the question. Did the accused touch you before the occasion on which you claim he raped you?" Everyone in the court knew that the answer had to be no, everyone except Mr. Freeman and me. I looked at his heavy face, trying to look as if he would have liked me to say no. I said no. The lie lumped in my throat, and I couldn't get air. How I despised the man for making me lie. Old mean, nasty thing. Old black, nasty thing. The tears didn't soothe my heart as they usually did. I screamed, "Old mean, dirty thing, dirty old thing." Our lawyer brought me off the stand and to my mother's arms. The fact that I had arrived at my desired destination by lies made it less appealing to me. Mr. Freeman was given 1 year and 1 day, but he never got a chance to do his time. His lawyer or someone got him released that very afternoon. In the living room, where the shades were drawn for coolness, Bailey and I played Monopoly on the floor. I played a bad game because I was thinking how I would be able to tell Bailey how I had lied, and even worse for our relationship, kept a secret from him. Bailey answered the doorbell because grandmother was in the kitchen. A tall white policeman asked for Mrs. Baxter. Had they found out about the lie? Maybe the policeman was coming to put me in jail because I had sworn on the Bible that everything I said would be the truth, the whole truth, so help me God. The man in our living room was taller than the sky and whiter than my image of God. He just didn't have the beard. Mrs. Baxter, I thought you ought to know. Freeman's been found dead on the lot behind the slaughterhouse. Softly, as if she were discussing a church program, she said, "Poor man." She wiped her hands on the dish towel and just as softly asked, "Do they know who did it?" The policeman said, "Seems like he was dropped there. Some say he was kicked to death." Grandmother's color only rose a little. "Tom, thanks for telling me. Poor man. Well, maybe it's better this way. He was a mad dog. Would you like a glass of lemonade or some beer?" Although he looked harmless, I knew he was a dreadful angel counting out my many sins. "No thanks, Mrs. Baxter. I'm on duty. Gotta be getting back. Well, tell your ma that I'll be over when I take up my beer and remind her to save some kraut for me." And the recording angel was gone. He was gone, and a man was dead because I lied. Where was the balance in that? One lie surely wouldn't be worth a man's life. Bailey could have explained it all to me, but I didn't dare ask him. Obviously, I had forfeited my place in heaven forever, and I was as gutless as the doll I had ripped to pieces ages ago. Even Christ himself turned his back on Satan. Wouldn't he turn his back on me? I could feel the evilness flowing through my body and waiting, pent up, to rush off my tongue if I tried to open my mouth. I clamped my teeth shut. I'd hold it in. If it escaped, wouldn't it flood the world and all the innocent people? Grandmother Baxter said, "Reety and Junior, you didn't hear a thing. I never want to hear this situation nor that evil man's name mentioned in my house again. I mean that." She went back into the kitchen to make apple strudel for my celebration. Even Bailey was frightened. He sat all to himself, looking at a man's death, a kitten looking at a wolf. Not quite understanding it, but frightened all the same. In those moments, I decided that although Bailey loved me, he couldn't help. I had sold myself to the devil, and there would be no escape. The only thing I could do was to stop talking to people other than Bailey. Instinctively, or somehow, I knew that because I loved him so much, I'd never hurt him. But if I talked to anyone else, that person might die too. Just my breath, carrying my words out, might poison people, and they'd curl up and die like the black fat slugs that only pretended. I had to stop talking. I discovered that to achieve perfect personal silence, all I had to do was attach myself leech-like to sound. I began to listen to everything. I probably hoped that after I had heard all the sounds, really heard them, and packed them down deep in my ears, the world would be quiet around me. I walked into rooms where people were laughing, their voices hitting the walls like stones, and I simply stood still in the midst of the riot of sound. After a minute or two, silence would rush into the room from its hiding place, because I had eaten up all the sounds. In the first weeks, my family accepted my behavior as a post-rape, post-hospital affliction. Neither the term nor the experience was mentioned in grandmother's house, where Bailey and I were again staying. They understood that I could talk to Bailey, but to no one else. Then came the last visit from the visiting nurse, and the doctor said I was healed. That meant I should be back on the sidewalks, playing handball, or enjoying the games I had been given when I was sick. When I refused to be the child they knew and accepted me to be, I was called impudent, and my muteness, sullenness. For a while, I was punished for being so uppity that I wouldn't speak. And then came the thrashings given by any relative who felt himself offended. We were on the train going back to Stamps, and this time it was I who had to console Bailey. He cried his heart out down the aisles of the coach and pressed his little boy body against the window pane, looking for a last glimpse of his mother dear. I have never known if Mama sent for us, or if the St. Louis family just got fed up with my grim presence. There is nothing more appalling than a constantly morose child. I cared less about the trip than about the fact that Bailey was unhappy, and had no more thought of our destination than if I had simply been heading for the toilet. 14. The barrenness of Stamps was exactly what I wanted, without will or consciousness. After St. Louis, with its noise and activity, its trucks and buses, and loud family gatherings, I welcomed the obscure lanes and lonely bungalows set back deep in dirt yards. The resignation of its inhabitants encouraged me to relax. They showed me a contentment based on the belief that nothing more was coming to them, although a great deal more was due. Their decision to be satisfied with life's inequities was a lesson for me. Entering Stamps, I had the feeling that I was stepping over border lines of the map and would fall without fear right off the end of the world. Nothing more could happen. For in Stamps, nothing happened. Into this cocoon I crept. For an indeterminate time, nothing was demanded of me, or of Bailey. We were, after all, Mrs. Henderson's California grandchildren, and had been away on a glamorous trip way up north to the fabulous St. Louis. Our father had come the year before, driving a big shiny automobile, and speaking the King's English with a big city accent. So all we had to do was lie quiet for months and rake in the profits of our adventures. Farmers and maids, cooks and handymen, carpenters, and all the children in town made regular pilgrimages to the store just to